Welcome to the Unchange Powerful Women series, where I'm celebrating women who have broken barriers, redefined success, and chosen to lead on their own terms. Today, I have the honor of speaking to my friend, Jeanette McGill, who recently became the oldest South African woman to summit Mount Everest. I've known Jeanette for over 25 years, maybe longer, and we also walked the Three Passes Trek together last year. She was one of my guides. This conversation is about more than standing on the highest peak in the world. It's about resilience, purpose, and power on your own terms. Jeanette's story isn't one of overnight success. It's a journey marked by years of preparation, both physical and emotional, and an unshakable belief in possibility. I know that climbing Everest has been a lifelong dream for Jeanette. This is not just a story about Everest. It's a conversation with a friend about what drives her as a human being. Welcome to the studio, Jeanette. Lovely to see you.
Thank you, Pietje. Great to be here.
I always like to start with a bit of an origin story. So what was your dream job as a child?
My dream job as a child was to work in nature conservation, as well as to be part of outdoor education, funny enough.
So it's always been about mountains and nature for you?
It absolutely has been. And, you know, I think the reality is that I started that. I wanted to do nature conservation, but very quickly was persuaded to go and do a basic Bachelor of Science degree at the local university. And then I was also leading for Outward Bound. It used to be Felt and Flay in South Africa.
Mm-hmm.
And that was really where working with people in the outdoors and leading in the outdoors really took root inside of me too.
Yes, I read somewhere, it must have been one of the articles I read about you, that you snuck into the mountain club at the age of 13. So what was going through your mind when you did that?
Well, growing up, my parents were into all kinds of different clubs and societies, and they bored me to death. It was the bird club and the tree club and the bee club and goodness knows what other clubs, but it was the mountain club that stuck with me. The opportunity to go whilst I was in junior school, high school, hiking and walking on the weekends. And I definitely took to the resilience and the tough environment that was the Eastern Cape. We would go into the outdoors of the Eastern Cape. The rule was you could only be 14 years old when you joined. But because I had spent the preceding years doing these things, yeah, I don't think they realized that I was that young. But yeah, it's quite fascinating to realize just how long I've been a member of the Mountain Club of South Africa for.
So why are mountains so important to you?
I've just always enjoyed the time that I can spend outdoors. I've been able to have clarity of focus. I think walking can be sometimes slightly meditative. And I've been able to solve all kinds of problems and challenges by just giving myself a bit of space through the outdoors. And that could have been in the executive roles that I've had, as well as the people that I do take into the outdoors. So it's just sort of been my gym, physical and mental.
Yeah, you spoke a little bit about having this dream of actually pursuing a career in nature and nature conservation and that, but that's not the route that you took. So what route did you take and where did you end up?
Yeah, the route I took me to the deepest point on the African continent. So instead of nature conservation, I studied zoology, but then I also studied geology. And it was that geology studies that saw me get a scholarship initially to go and study at Rhodes University in Grahamstown. And then through that, I started working on the gold mines of South Africa. And this was in the late 1990s, where it was still actually illegal for women to work underground full time. There were two ways that women could work underground in South Africa. The first was if you were a nurse or had to support some event that required some health assistance underground. And the second way of getting underground was as a geologist, because you worked a part shift underground. So women couldn't study mining engineering because that would have meant a whole shift underground. But as a geologist, we would map underground and then come to the surface. And so instead of studying mining engineering, I studied geology, and that gave me a pathway to working on South African gold mines. And yes, I was the first technical woman to work on all the mines that I've worked on. And then I also pursued and got a underground blasting certificate as well. So definitely grew up, took that challenge that I had in the outdoors in the real mountains, and I put that back underground.
Yeah, and where did that lead you?
Well, you know, definitely working my way through the ladder, as it were, from, you know, working underground, being able then to run various leadership programs above ground. I suppose what I've done is, with my career, I've broken it into really three main segments. And the first one was very much that on the mine, hands-on skills development, being able to do a range of activities, both in geology, mineral economics. I worked in a variety of fields where I could then also go and do advisory work. The second phase was then into the very much the application of this and the various executive roles that I've had in technology leadership, both in South Africa for producers, as well as overseas for some of the supply companies, into that executive space.
So you did quite a lot of like geology work and worked in the mining industry and all of that. Is there any sort of pivotal moment in your career that changed your direction forever?
Not really. You know, in all honesty, I guess for me, it was just a sequential transition from one thing to the next challenge. You know, I started in geology, and then I saw a different opportunity and I pursued that, and then I had an opportunity to go into leadership roles. So for me, there's no pivotal moment per se, but it's this willingness to take on challenges and to see things differently and then go and test and trial those.
Yeah, so it was like more like a natural progression. Just keep on moving upwards, like climbing that corporate ladder.
Absolutely.
Just keep on going. So what were some of the biggest barriers you faced in that journey?
Absolutely. From a gender perspective. And then there was also the crossover gender into different cultures. So I've been exceptionally fortunate to be able to have an incredible team that I've always worked around and supported. But as I already alluded to, when I started on the mining journey, I was always the only woman working underground. And so, you know, as much as my team supported me, I did come across some challenges there. And then I was able to take my geology and my mining work into other cultures. So I've worked throughout Africa. I've gone to mines in China and a variety of other geographies, South America as well. I've been there. And then, of course, I've been, you know, mountaineering around the world too. And I think oftentimes these cultures are fairly new to having women in senior leadership roles. I remember once being in Mali, in Bamako, and it was very new for that culture to be dealing with a woman in charge. And definitely being able to lead into those spaces and to come with the empathy, understanding where they're coming from, but at the same time, knowing that I've got my own stakeholders that are expecting me to deliver as well. And so the barriers around gender and the perception that comes along with that has definitely been some of the challenges that I've had to progress through.
Yeah, I think we've walked a very similar path. You know, we were just in different mining houses or different places in the world, but we were sort of fighting the similar battles in the places that we were employed in. Did you ever feel like you had to prove yourself more than others?
No, I do. I guess so. And I will be honest enough, I guess, and share that I do have some formative wiring that predisposes me to needing to be validated, and that's enough I'll say about that. And I really sort of understand then why I went and, you know, I've got 5 degrees and I had this sort of tick list that I worked through, and I thought that that was important. But then funnily enough, it's been my journey in the outdoors that has shown me that tick list, whilst it was valid, it was also not necessarily as needed. And, when I first started doing high altitude mountaineering, I felt like I had to prove myself, but that's been part of my Everest journey, which has been that I truly and absolutely did that for myself. And so proving myself potentially, yes, in the outset, but right now, definitely not.
Yeah. So has mountaineering always been a part of your life, you know, from the age of 13, 14, have you always woven it into whatever else you were doing? So it has always been like this counterpoint, corporate Jeanette versus outdoor Jeanette.
Yeah, absolutely. I did have a short stint when I was studying my PhD in Colorado that, whilst it was an amazing outdoor environment, I didn't do as much mountaineering as I possibly could have or should have, but the PhD studies were significant. But yes, absolutely. Up to that point, and most definitely past that point, it has been a counterpoint because, as I said, it's an environment which I feel at peace in. I feel that I can think through things and strategize and show up as a much better leader in the executive space when I've also spent my weekends challenging myself. And so, yes, you know, in all my corporate roles, all my leave has been used to go on mountaineering expeditions.
Yeah. So was it always going to be Everest? Okay. From the very beginning, was it always like the end goal to get there? Or did that happen sort of later as your confidence grew and you became better at what you were doing?
You know, Pietra, my Everest journey has been really sort of an interesting one for me. And I guess I call it my Steve Jobs journey, insofar as we all know that Steve Jobs said you cannot, look at the dots going forward and you can only connect them looking backwards. And my Everest journey is one of those things, insofar as back in 1995, when I was studying at Rhodes, this competition came out in the Sunday Times newspaper, and it was asking for women to apply to be part of a competition that would select a woman to join already pre-selected men as climbers to be the first South African expedition to Everest. And needless to say, that became the 1996 season, which has been well represented in the press and the public sphere, and people can go look at that. And it was during that process that I really had to ask myself, is this something that I wanted to do? And I thought it was, and people had said, you're well experienced in the outdoors. But I also knew of the people that probably were more connected than me at the time and probably stood there for just to do their connections, had a better chance of being successful. And I was studying, I was doing my honors at the time. And it was this decision. I remember tearing up the newspaper in my res room and saying, no, you know, I'm just going to follow my career. But actually my dream, it's sort of the seed had been planted back then, but I just buried it. And then I continued with this corporate career and my mountaineering, you know, I used it recreationally very much so. And then, you know, as one develops in the mountaineering space, I'd done the Kilimanjaros, and then I wanted to see if I can get to 6,000 meters. And when you get to 6,000 meters, you want to see if you can get to 7,000 meters. And naturally, we decide, you know, I wanted to know if my body can work up at 8,000 meters. Because funny enough, in people's bodies, there's a natural ceiling. Not everybody can get to these exceptionally extreme altitudes. And it was only when I'd had some of this pre-existing experience climbing 8,000-meter mountains, I'm the first South African woman to do some mountains and the first South African in totality to climb some mountains. It was only then that it almost went full circle where I went, you know what, I actually wouldn't mind trying Everest. I kept the goal quite quiet from people because I find Everest can be quite polarizing in the public space. And I did have two attempts at Everest, and for various reasons, they didn't work out. And eventually I had to be quite outspoken and I had to own that goal. I found that it was really easy to encourage others to lead through their goals, but I had to take this, you know, this path to be able to really be standing up about my own personal Everest goal. And I was very happy to summit this year in 2025, which basically means my Everest journey has been a path of resilience and self-belief that's taken a good 30 years to reach fruition.
Yeah, I mean, it was amazing to be able to chat to you last year when you were sort of getting your headspace correct, for having had the sickness and the failures and the stuff with the previous attempt and then starting to get your body and your mindset correct for the next season. It was actually quite a transformation that I could witness in what was happening in you. Mm-hmm. And then following you on Polar Steps on that app, every little post you posted, I am now at this camp, now I'm at this camp. And then that harrowing story of like slipping down the mountain and everything. It was like this, I was in this real life adventure of Jeanette conquering Everest, you know. But I know you don't like to say you conquer a mountain. You are somebody who likes to work in partnership with the mountain. Would you like to say something about that?
Yes, absolutely. I think that in, for want of a better word, the patriarchal space where it's power over, unfortunately, the narrative has been around conquering mountains, but it's definitely not like that. For me, the mountaineering space is about preparation. It's about witnessing yourself as well as others out there. And it's a true privilege to be allowed to summit these mountains. And I definitely firmly believe that, you know, it's an honor and we've got to prepare ourselves correctly to be able to do this. And, you know, with the modern narrative where a lot of people are going into mountaineering now, I do think that some people take this for granted, but true mountaineers definitely don't take the opportunity to reach these unique places. You know, we definitely look to them as a special moment.
Yeah, I mean, just following you on your journey and just seeing all the things and challenges that you had to face, and it didn't sound to me as if it was easy. Okay? It didn't sound to me as if there was a long line of people waiting to summit. All these things that you see in social media of it becoming like a tourist destination, it did not sound to me as if you were a tourist. It sounded like you were facing a real challenge. I think there's a lot of misconceptions about what it is to climb Everest.
Yeah, I would say so. And there's probably three main misnomers around Everest. The first one definitely is the lines. And I was very fortunate enough, based on my experience and based on my logistical setup, I was able to summit just myself and my Sherpa. But the interesting thing is they condemn the lines on Everest. But if you go and you look at a race like trail running, the UTMB race in Mont Blanc, they have 10,000 people over one weekend. We have 700 climbers on Everest over 6 weeks. And so I think that Everest is often taken out of, you know, context there. The other big thing, of course, is people say there's bodies on Everest everywhere. And one of the interesting things that I look at as well is there's been about 354 deaths on Everest. But if you look at a sport like the Ironman, the full Ironman, since the inception of Ironman, 250 people have died running the Ironman, but that's not really well known. And so I do believe that things like lines, things like deaths are the challenge that we have to be able to create a positive perception around climbing Everest. But obviously some of the real challenges do talk to things like climate change at the moment.
Yeah. Yeah. So you were 52 years old when you summited Everest, which makes you officially the oldest South African woman to summit Everest. How did the age thing make you do this in a different way?
It really helped me own my experience. I didn't realize that I would be that, but I do enjoy studying. I like numbers. I like data. And so having been somebody who does have access to the Himalayan database, it was out of curiosity to check back from a South African perspective to see who had done what when. I'd learned that the oldest South African so far to summit Everest is a guy who's 55 years old when he summited. The previous oldest South African woman, she summited when she was 49. So the reality is that whilst, you know, it's a nice thing to say about it, from an actual climbing perspective, it meant that I had to own the age. The ageism is quite rife in the mountaineering space, and really being able to own why I'm there in my experience. But at the flip side, I do believe that older women in particular are really strong when it comes to an endurance perspective, and we're able to put our heads down and just keep going and keep going. You can see this in sports like marathon mountain biking, as well as, you know, the trail running races and things like that. And so for me, being an older climber meant that one, I could really own the experience that I had. It's blatant when you can look at the ice wall on Everest, you can see who's got the experience and who hasn't. And then just being able to keep that experience in my pocket such that I could manage my logistics, my health, my mental health, all of those things as well. So it actually really definitely supported my summit. I think that younger people, they summit, they might summit first time out of the gates, but I think sometimes it's by a bit of luck and obviously a support of their Sherpa community.
So what has changed for you since you've done the summit?
I'm so much lighter. You know, I did feel that the monkey had got off my back. You know, I wasn't very outspoken. I wasn't very adamant around my Everest goal. But now that it's going on for 6 months after my summit, 4 or 5 months or so, every time I reflect back on it, it's like, wow, I've done it. And yeah, definitely feel a lot lighter about things and a lot more able to take control and have self-leadership. As I'd said, I love working with groups. I love leading groups. But a portion of this has also been the self-leadership that comes along with this journey.
It must have been such a powerful, I know you were in that headspace last year and you were just getting ready for it. And it was like, I have to, if I don't do this, then my 80-year-old self is going to be very angry with me for not having at least tried one more time. So I'm very glad you did it and you got to the top. We were all following you and like cheering you on. It was amazing to witness that. So you spoke a little bit about barriers and navigating, you know, self-doubts and all of those sort of things. So what do you do to maintain your sense of self, you know, when you get to places where you start doubting yourself?
Yeah, you know, it's also been part of my journey. And from my perspective, it's a tool that I think is underutilized because people don't use it correctly, and that is values. I do believe that by spending time and figuring out what your own personal set of values are becomes such a strong North Star. You know, and you go through these exercises. We do them in corporate. We do them, you know, in personal development, and we pick words out of a list that might resonate for ourselves. And I've done that, and I had sort of words, but yet over the past year, I really spent some time on the sabbatical that I've taken to work with that even more. And I've distilled myself down into 5 core values, which resonate with me, and they are absolutely my North Stars right now. And they're the yardstick that I can test a lot of things with in my life. So values, very important.
And really knowing yourself, you know, and really doing that deep inner work.
Absolutely.
Yeah. Yeah. I think it's valuable at any time in your life just to take a short break and just to really get back to what's really important to you. And you've been doing that. So looking back now, what would you tell that honest student about tearing up the newspaper and not applying for that Everest expedition?
Such a great question, Petra. Thanks for it. You know, my younger self probably wishes she had actually gone for that, in all honesty, at the time. But do I regret the other alternative path and the executive space that I've been in? No, not at all. But I think the advice that I would have given my younger self is to do more of what I wanted and less of what I thought was expected of me. And that might sound really odd coming from somebody who has done this amazing amount of things and done and experienced so much globally. But in all honesty, there was still a veneer of having to be the quintessential good girl and doing what was expected, even though I was pushing boundaries in the mining space or from a gender perspective in the outdoors. But I think I would have actually liked to have even done more of what I wanted to do.
Yeah, and you have to learn that lesson during the course of your life. It's so silly that you only learn this when you're 50. You go, you know, actually, I could have just followed my dreams. What was I thinking? Because you sort of think you have to do what other people want or expect from you.
Yeah, I'm super grateful that I can now have had that time and the space to take my Everest journey back 30 years.
Yeah. So what does success look like for you these days?
Success means being able to follow my own goals in my own time with space, with empathy, and with care. And also to have a far sort of simpler approach to things. Being able to be simply successful is a real privilege.
Yeah. What type of legacy would you like to leave behind? I know you do quite a lot of work in supporting other female mountaineers as well.
Yeah. So I do love supporting other people. I do support a scholarship for a mountaineering organization, and I fund a scholarship specifically allocated to African women, which I really felt is really important because female mountaineers across the African continent are so underserved. And I've been able to, through that process, support people from countries like Kenya and Ethiopia and South Africa as well. So that's been a massive privilege. I don't have children of my own, so I do often reflect on what a legacy could be and would be. And for me, it's about, you know, being able to probably leave some written material, a book behind, but also just at the end of the day to know and to other people to know that I'm definitely somebody who tried her best, always tried her best, and had an immense amount of fun whilst doing it.
Mm. You are calling me at this point in time from Nepal. So you're in Nepal, in Kathmandu. So the last week has been quite an exciting one for Nepal. How's it been to live through a revolution?
Thank you so much for the question. And yes, where we stand in this moment in time is that, yes, last week there was, I guess one could call it, a real life revolution here in Nepal, where the Gen Z community really took it upon themselves to protest against the absolute abject corruption that is in place in the country of Nepal. And for me, from a bystander's perspective, firstly, I will share that one of the buildings that was torched happened to be right outside my window here. And so to have a front row seat at all of that, whilst shocking in the moment, I do take a bit of a more circumstantial view and say that it's actually felt like a real privilege to be right here, right now, in a country going through these changes. Democracy is fairly young in Nepal, similar to South Africa as well. And to just be able to take a step back and compare and contrast and look at the challenges people and life and countries go through has actually been a privilege. And so whilst, you know, people are concerned about safety, I'm somebody that has been in Nepal for a long time. And I've really taken the opportunity to look at this more strategically, holistically, and what does it mean from a leadership lens, both for people as well as for self-leadership.
Yeah, I think they're sending a real message to the world around tolerating corruption. And I think that's a really powerful message. So if you had to come across a woman right now that's facing her own personal Everest, whether it is an actual mountain or some emotional thing that they want to conquer, although we don't conquer, we work with, what advice would you give that woman?
Yeah, I really sort of break this path down into three main points. And I agree, Everests can be very personal. They can be public and can be a challenge that you're taking on for one moment in time. It can be something that you're going to take a couple of years to achieve. And for me, I'd break this leadership path and getting to your personal Everest down into three distinct steps. And for me, the first one is commitment. You actually have to commit to yourself, let alone others, that this is what you're going to do. It happened on my Everest journey. I played it safe. I played it quiet for the first attempts. And then I had to commit to myself. And then I was able to have the freedom to set up my entire lifestyle around what I wanted to do. So if you have a goal, you've got to commit to it, because then you can lead yourself through to that point. But once you've committed to that goal, you do have to put in the work, and that work comes around consistency. And so the same way we might fill in a dot on a calendar to do whatever you want to do, you've got to do it. And I firmly believe in the little things actually add up to the big things. And I know that when you joined me last year, the training that you did was part of that consistency. You saw the big elephant of a 25-day odd trekking trip and broke it down and was just tackling it on a consistent basis. And then the final aspect that I would share after the commitment, the consistency, is then courage. You do have to just simply have that courage to be able to back yourself, to stand up against naysayers, to share it with family, to share it with friends. And that courage will then support the self-belief to be able to take on your own personal Everest.
Yeah, I'm a firm believer that you have to courageously work towards your goals and tell everybody about it. If you keep it quiet, then you sort of give yourself an out. So it's better to say, I'm going to do this. And at least just aim for that. And if you don't get all the way there, at least you got part way there. You know, you're already in a much better place than you were when you started off. So is there anything else that you would like to talk about that we haven't spoken about yet?
I'd probably want to share from a leadership perspective, especially, you know, we'd spoken earlier that I've been on the forefront of some of the gender challenges that we defined in the female space as leaders. And because we are now women that were often at the forefront of leadership when we were younger, and we are able to pull people along behind us, means that that's been great. And I've been able to watch those full circle moments. But at the same time, we're still pushing barriers and boundaries. And one of those things comes to women being older in the leadership space without having ageism push against us, as well as some of the, you know, the challenges that we have as we enter our later lives. And for me, what I would share then is around that fear and the self-leadership is a muscle. And it's a muscle like any muscle which you've got to take to the gym. It's a muscle that needs to get stretched. If you haven't run or walked around the block for a while, you've got to go and start slow. And I think as women, especially we get older, we stop to stretch our fear muscle and how we talk and how we do things the older we get. And so probably the last thing is just to encourage everybody to keep stretching your fear muscle. It doesn't have to be going all the way to 8,000 meters in the top of the world. It doesn't have to be 4 kilometers beneath the surface of the earth either. But whatever it is, you know, go out there, go and experience new things, do new things, read new books, see new people, and keep stretching your fear muscle as we get older.
I do love that message. And I'm just wondering, now that you have this Everest monkey off your back, what's next for Jeanette?
Well, I'm a mountaineer through and through. It's beyond, it's a passion, but it's just who I am. So I'm absolutely not giving up my mountaineering trajectory. But it's about having a portfolio of responsibilities, leadership opportunities, both in the corporate space, in the outdoor space, and being able to lead with my values and being able to provide opportunities for other people to be their best selves, be that in the boardroom or on the mountain trail.
Yeah, thank you so much for joining me in the studio. It's been absolutely wonderful to speak to you.
You're welcome. Thank you, Pietje.
Thank you for listening to another episode of Unchange. In line with the theme for this podcast series, Jeanette is building a legacy in motion, supporting African women climbers, mentoring future leaders, and proving that it's never too late to chase your wildest, most meaningful goals. I hope that this episode has given you some courage to tackle whatever mountain you are facing. Remember, your story matters, you are powerful, and by telling your story, you are paving the way for others.